Welcome to the North and South of Things podcast, a show dedicated to discussion of topics important to the LGBT community and the community at large. Here are your hosts, Mark and George.
Welcome, everyone, to the North and South of Things. I'm Mark in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Minnesota, and joining me today is...
I'm George in Atlanta, Georgia.
Welcome, George. It's a snowy December morning. We've had a couple of inches of snow overnight, and I am very grateful that my snow thrower continues to work.
And by snow thrower, I hope you are referring to some mechanical device.
Yeah, the other day it wasn't quite as much snow, and I actually had to use the manual shovel. That wasn't too much fun.
Not at all. Well, I'm happy to say it is a balmy 66 degrees after having gotten down into the 30s a few days ago. We're back to Atlanta winter weather. It's supposed to reach a high of 71 today.
Awesome. You know, back to Atlanta weather kind of leads us back to a show that you and I have done in the past called The North and South of Things. And you reached out not too long ago and asked if I would be interested in sort of revisiting this as a show that the two of us would like to do. And I, of course, said yes.
It roughly had about 30, 33, 34 episodes previously. Fascinating conversations. We try and pick a topic and sort of hammer that topic. And I think. If you're in agreement, I think that's the approach we'll continue moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. There just seems to be so much happening today in the world. And I think it's important to kind of bring our own perspective into what's been happening, especially in the last couple of years with the current president. And some of the themes and overarching issues and how they come into play, especially when it relates to LGBT people and specifically us.
Yeah, it is a, in many ways, a new world. I'm not sure how brave the new world is, but I think we're going to have to be brave in that new world.
Absolutely. And I think one of the important parts of this brave new world is to make sure that we kind of hunker down and check in with our tribes and our people, because there's a lot of effort that's being put in to drive wedges in between people. And I think it's important for us to come together to find some common ground despite all of the insanity that seems to be happening right now. And I know for me personally, it's been a rough row to hoe. And it's been something that I've been thinking a lot about and trying to do my best to continue the resistance, because I think it's important, especially going forward. We do see a little bit of hope on the horizon with the Democratic Party taking back the House of Representatives. And I think I am hoping that is a turning point.
Yeah, I think I'm very concerned about how stark in one direction the Democratic Party will go. I'm not sure it's well served to go full bore against Trump for purposes of impeachment. I'd like them to go into that very thoughtfully, very carefully. I think there are things that need to be investigated or continued to be investigated. Most important, I think, just having the ability to put the brakes on things that shouldn't be moving forward. Of course, he's got the power of the presidential resolution, if you will. So he'll still be able to carry on a good bit despite us having won the House back. But yeah, big news this weekend.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I can say that a lot of us waking up yesterday morning to the news of the passing of George H.W. Bush at the age of 94 is probably the thing that's going to dominate the news cycle from now through his funeral. But, you know, when I start to see these remembrances of a past president or a past politician or dignitary, this is problematic. And these problematic remembrances, because, yes, President Bush was a politician. He was our president at a time where we did have a little bit more civility. We had dialogue between opposing viewpoints, but he was also very problematic as a president. And I think I'd like to quote one of a friend of mine, Sigrid Ellis, who is a writer and editor, and she had a tweet yesterday that says, "I can acknowledge that a loss of any one of us diminishes the potential of all of us. I can recognize that people are not always who they once were, and I can, at the same time, remember and hold people responsible for the evil that they have done." I think this is so well put because, say what you will, President Bush was at the heart of ignoring the AIDS crisis back in the 80s and the 90s. He led us to a Gulf War and various other things. So when we come to idolize these politicians and leaders, it's important for us to hold these opposing viewpoints at the same time, because it allows us to really critically think about their legacy. And people are complicated and people are human. They make mistakes. I'm sure he would probably admit that he made mistakes. And it's at this time where we do need to be critical. And I'm not saying that we speak ill of the dead. Right. But what I am saying is we have to look at the complete picture, both the good and the bad, at the same time in order to have an accurate representation of this man.
I think I'm struck by our collective national proclivity to immediately put those who have been in positions of power, put those people on a pedestal upon their passing. That's a lot of P's. I'm glad I have my pop filter on. The simple fact is he is in fact human. He did, in my opinion, make some bad steps along the way. I feel as though despite, you know, he's got a very mixed record on LGBT. He did he did some positive things, although he was not pro marriage equality, and he was extremely slow to respond to the AIDS epidemic, as was his predecessor, and they'll have to carry that legacy into infinity, and the record will speak very clearly on that. I've often wondered, Mark, if Bush, the one thing, if you just go look up George W. Bush legacy, positive legacy, the one thing he will get considerable attention and kudos for was his PEPFAR program and for funding the PEPFAR program, because he is responsible for saving millions of lives in Africa, in turning the AIDS epidemic around. There are any number of people on both sides of the aisle and those who don't want to be in an aisle at all that recognize what he did. And I've often wondered if his commitment to that. Now, U2's Bono gets a lot of credit for having visited with George W. Bush and saying, you need to support this and you need to fully fund it. But I wonder, in fact, if George W. Bush's own acknowledgement or recognition that his father didn't do as much for the AIDS crisis prompted him in some ways to sort of make up for that.
Well, it's hard to know. But one thing is for sure that, you know, as history shows, if there is an amount of compassion, there is the possibility for change. Mm-hmm. And that's what is so alarming to me now in our current state of things, that there doesn't seem to be compassion for people that are not, you know, cis, white, hetero people. And this is concerning to me, because when you demonize other people, then you have the environment that allows a country to dispatch military personnel down to our southern border, where they tear gas women and children. This is happening.
Yeah, it does create an environment that becomes hostile. I will say, I think President George W. Bush, 41, let's call him, I do think 41's language was nowhere near as incendiary as our current president. Still not helpful, don't get me wrong, but was nowhere near as incendiary as President Trump. He also, some articles, obviously there's a flood of articles sort of looking back at his legacy and particularly the LGBT issues. And, you know, he has been quoted as saying that his stances on LGBT rights have mellowed over the years. He still thinks that marriage should be between a man and a woman. But honestly, in today's world, people should be allowed to be happy. Everybody deserves the right to be happy. It's a good acknowledgement, but you know, it's still equivocating in my book. So I'm not going to give him a pass on that. You know what I will say, Mark, is there is something instructive that could serve us now about the Bush Clinton era, particularly HW and Bill. That we could learn from. Somehow the Bush family, I mean, the Clinton absolutely drubbed 41, you know, in that election. And it was not viewed, I'm sure there was some painful things, you know, felt by the Bush family that come about as a part of the election process. But what surfaced in the news in the last few days was this letter that HW left Bill Clinton, as is customary, the outgoing president leaves the incoming president sort of a personal note. And you couldn't get a more gracious and thoughtful note from somebody across the aisle. And I feel like there is something to be learned about that ability to disagree, even vehemently, without attacking each other personally and trying to destroy each other.
Exactly. And actually, I have that letter up in front of me now, and it is short. So I think we should read it, because I think this is a demonstrative of the kind of character that President Bush had.
Yeah, please do.
All right. It says, "Dear Bill, when I walked into this office just now, I felt the same sense of wonder and respect that I felt 4 years ago. I know you will feel that too. I wish you great happiness here. I never felt the loneliness some presidents have described. There will be very tough times, made even more difficult by criticism you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off course. You will be our president when you read this note. I wish you well. I wish your family well. Your success now is our country's success. I am rooting hard for you. Good luck, George.
Yeah, that's pretty stunning in terms of its level of civility, level of hospitality, level of support, the American tradition of one leader at a time. I can't say enough about how gracious that note was and how helpful it must have been.
So how did we get from that to here?
You know, it is a very interesting path, and what may surprise most folks is that it had nothing to do with the state of Florida. In this instance, it's Georgia's fault, right? Kids, there's an article in the Atlantic, the November issue of the Atlantic, called "The Man Who Broke Politics," and it is a extremely important read to understand how Newt Gingrich, representative from Georgia, became Speaker of the House. His rise to power, his intentional effort to be a disruptor, to be an obstructionist, to really break down the institution of government that we know today, because in his mind, American civilization was at peril. It is a long read, I'm not going to lie. It is very interesting, and it will answer so many questions, at least fill in some holes. To be sure, as we shared before, Mark, ugliness and ill-temperedness and ill-manneredness has existed in American politics since America existed. But modern day, where we find ourselves today, that same ugliness gave way to this sense of gentility, you know, this sense of comedy, this sense of understanding that there are rules and we need to abide by those rules, and those rules are meant for us to sort of work together across the aisle to achieve the common good. And Newt Gingrich is single-handedly responsible for the disruption. His rise, the article points to an early 1978, if you can believe it, speech he gave to a group of young Republicans in suburban Atlanta. And it went right through to his election, to his training and schooling other congressional candidates across the U.S. in terms of how to understand that this is a war for power. That phrase is used a number of times. You use every tool that you can. You start using, names. You start taking any issue of any negativity and assigning that to the liberal agenda. A crime has happened, somebody's molested, somebody's raped, and you automatically assign. So it is a war of personal politics, and he weaponized it. By the time he was instrumental in winning back the House during President Clinton's midterm, he became the Speaker of the House, and if everyone will remember the big group of 300 incoming or candidates signing the contract with America, you'll remember that signing out on the steps of the Capitol. Not only did he was he a disruptor. He trained others on how to do this, how to go about the same approach. In my opinion, Mark, that gave rise to the Tea Party. That gave rise to dissent that happens in a very inappropriate way. It personalizes it. It attacks. We see Obama come in office after President Bush. Backing up, Max Cleland was running for a position in Georgia. Max Cleland is a veteran who's in a wheelchair because he's lost his legs in war, right?
Mm-hmm.
His veteran service was attacked much like, and frankly, by the same guy, Corsi, who's in the news now, that John Kerry was attacked for the Swift boating, right? So it's been an intentional attack to deride, demean, and dehumanize people in the path that are in your path to power. And Newt Gingrich is singly responsible modern day for bringing that life back, or bringing that to our, you know, to the political forefront. Again, I think this gives rise to the Tea Party. I think this Tea Party is where some of that, where some of the hate and vitriol begins to foment and come out from under the carpet, right? Mm-hmm. We had swept all this national racism and xenophobia and anti-Semitic behavior. That didn't go away. It was just under the carpet. It was in the closet, right? Mm-hmm. And the Tea Party, funded by the Koch brothers, I might add, well-established as sort of bringing that back to, yes, it was guised under, you know, fiscal responsibility and smaller government and things of that nature. And Obama gets elected, and this just is gasoline on the fire, you know? Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you remember that the night of President Obama's inauguration, all of the Republican congressional leaders met at a steakhouse in Washington. And it was determined at that time that they would obstruct anything and everything put forth by President Obama. They would not allow a single thing to get passed. We will not let this black man have any success whatsoever. Do you know who was at that meeting, Mark?
Let me guess. Newt Gingrich.
Ding, ding, ding. Yes. Yes. And so he brings him right through to today. And because Obama inherited this ridiculously awful economic situation, I talked with a banker, crossing streams, work life and podcast life, and I promise not to do that. But I talked to a banker for a work-related issue and was interviewing him for a video presentation. And he spoke about the early days of the crisis. And he reaffirmed, which was nice to hear from somebody in the financial sector, something I have long held and long understood, is that our entire financial system came so close to collapse at the same time as W was going out of office and Obama was coming into office. Had they not taken the actions they took to put all the banks through the stress tests and force marriages between the banks who had had exposed themselves to too much risk with these bad mortgage products sandwiched with good products and securitizing them. And we could go on for hours about that. But we came so close to economic collapse. And it was because of the decisions that were made, partly by President Bush. He had to make some of those on his way out the door. And then what President Obama had to do. We were very close to financial collapse. Mm-hmm. The very actions they took to prevent the second depression, the second depression our nation would have faced, the very actions they took to prevent that from happening are being mocked, and he's being, you know, being credited for having run up the debt. He saved this country. You know, it was those efforts of him and other President Obama and others that saved this country from certain financial ruin by putting these policies in place. And the bailouts in place. Nobody was happy about the bailouts, but they needed to happen, right? So meanwhile, you've got Congress here who's said point blank, this is documented now. This is not folly. This is not hyperbole. They said, we're not going to let a single thing pass under this president. And so that obstruction led to what? Stagnant growth. So even if you look at that chart, even with their obstruction, the economy did improve because of those efforts, but not as fast as they needed to. So John Doe and the Appalachians and, you know, Jane Doe in the Rust Belt and somebody else in the, you know, Midwest. And I mean, like, those people are not, they're coal miners. They're not seeing success. They're not seeing improvement. And here you've got a newt informed approach to disenfranchisement and unhappiness. And that's Obama's fault, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's utterly absurd, but it gives rise to Trump. It gives rise to Trump. Let's blow this shit up. Let's be disruptors. Let's make it happen. Meanwhile, wink and a nod and a dog whistle to every, you know, anti-Semitic, you know, white nationalist group known to man.
Exactly. And this, the continued dismantling of all of what Obama had achieved during his two terms, I think we're going to see a very significant effect on the U.S. economy. And I think you're going to start seeing that probably by the second quarter of 2019. And it's going to be when folks like you and like me start filing their tax returns and finding out just how screwed over they've been by this quote-unquote tax cut. It's simply unsustainable. And
yeah, and you hit on it earlier. Let's keep dividing us with these wedge issues so we are distracted and not paying attention to the fact that you just gave the wealthiest of Americans this massive tax break. You included just enough to give some in the middle class and upper middle class a little bit of a break that is not going to be the break they think it is once they do their taxes this year. I agree that's going to happen. And now you're Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham. I think it's more Mitch McConnell, but now you're talking about, you know, our deficit is driven by entitlement programs.
Right. And that eye on the prize that the GOP has been wanting to get rid of for decades, which is Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security.
And I'm not sure, to be honest with you, how successful they're going to be. I'm not sure that they won't be successful. But I do know that it is a third rail. It is the lifeblood of so many senior citizens. And I don't know about you, but I did the math last night. I've been paying into that system for 28 years, mm-hmm. you know. And I have to face the reality that there's a better than given – the court appointments, given the Supreme Court appointments, given the success of divisive issues, given the success of populism, I don't know about you, but like it feels like it's a less than a 50-50 chance of surviving under the current approach.
Well, that, and we haven't even brought in the elephant that's in the middle of the room, which is climate change. And how yeah. that is going to affect our economy, our society, and our politics, our government. It's all interconnected.
And just the everyday, and folks peeling back the curtain a little bit, Mark and I said before we pressed record that we didn't want this to turn into a Trump bashing. But Mark, I'm struck by the notion that people feel, I know it's exhausting. Mm-hmm. I know it's exhausting. I know people get tired of hearing about it. But my God, what this man does on a daily basis to erode the underpinning of our society. It would be derelict to not speak up and say something.
Well, absolutely. And I was having a conversation with a friend of mine not too long ago. I think this was right before the election. and we were discussing, you know, voter participation and the possibility of us taking back the House. And she had a very pointed remark that basically she said, I feel as long as people have a little money in their pockets and they're able to get their toys and, you know, stream Hulu and Netflix, they're not going to go to the polls. So, and I think that's a valid point. You know, I know that I personally went through a lot of my contacts. I have my nephews who are younger. They're in their late teens, early 20s. And I spent a lot of time reaching out to them, making sure that they were registered to vote, that they had planned to go to the polls. And I was at Thanksgiving at my sister's, and two of my nephews were there, and my nephew's new boyfriend, all of voting age. And my elder nephew did vote, and so did his new boyfriend. So they understand the importance of participating in the process. They were honest with me. They said, I really don't follow politics. I don't understand a lot. So I have to do the work and the research in order to make my vote count in a way that's appropriate. And then I also found out that my younger nephew did not vote, despite my sister's insistence, you know. And I looked at him and I said, nephew, that's unacceptable. You will not do that in 2020. You may not understand how important it is right now, but it is unacceptable not to participate in our process.
Yeah, it not to sound defeatist, but I'm about to sound defeatist. I worry that the horse is out of the barn.
Yeah.
The Supreme Court's already is already very far tilted to the right. Mm-hmm. My only hope is that President Trump's continued asshattery as mocking and attacking the judiciary will force Justice Roberts to have a spine surgically inserted, and stand up to him as he did recently. My only hope is that those who are appointed eventually understand the full weight of responsibility on their shoulders and don't make this a Christian nation.
Right.
You know, you are 100% within your rights to worship the way you feel. You are not within your rights to force me to live by your religious beliefs and tenets. And I'm also worried, you know, I've said this to friends, you know, when you estimate what percentage of the population, the voting population, that Trump will always have his base, no matter what the man does. Mm-hmm. He wasn't lying when he ran for office. I could go out on Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody in the face and people would still love me. It's true. Mm-hmm. It's not hyperbole. He could, and he would. I mean, he would have the continued support of those people if he justified that action in some way. By my estimation, that is 30% of the voting public, right? You add to that the percent of people who will vote party over country, that are in the Republicans. I can't remember who told me this recently. I feel like it was a Georgian Atlanta podcast guest or somebody else, but or I may have heard it on another podcast. But you know, the old adage that Democrats fall in love, Republicans fall in line. Mm-hmm. So that is to say, the Democrats have to be in love with the candidate before they will support him or her. And Republicans don't fall in love. They just fall in line. They vote for whatever the R is. And between those two populations, his base, his indetractable base, and the percent of people who will vote for the R, period, regardless of who it is, I worry that that's going to be another victory in 2020 for him.
Well, I'm personally am steeling myself for that eventuality. I mean, if you look at the way the GOP has gerrymandered the voting, the very documentable voter suppression tactics that they have used in the years, and you put on top of that, you know, a foreign power such as Russia affecting our election, I would not be surprised if he was reelected in 2020. Now,
yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to sit on my laurels and say, woe is me. I will do everything in my limited sense of power and agency in order to make that not happen.
And that's a very good point. And I would echo that. I mean, I don't intend to sit idly by thinking this is a lost cause, because I don't necessarily think it is a lost cause. I do have faith in America. I do have faith in Americans. I don't have as much faith in America and Americans as I did, you know, 10 years mm-hmm. ago, 4 years ago, 2 years ago. But I do think when it comes right down to it, we do know right from wrong. To elect him again is acknowledging wrong and is knowingly accepting wrong, because you've seen what he does day in and day out. And Mark, I'm probably as disappointed with mainstream media. I know they've taken in many instances a hard tact approach. CNN has boldly put on the Chiron label at the bottom of the screen, you know, calling out his lies whenever he lies. Mm-hmm. They've taken some bold steps. They've been very forward in that. But this notion of false equivalency, Mark, is beyond frustrating for me. In a week in October, November, you had, you know, a record number of Jewish worshipers killed.
Mm-hmm.
You had a black couple shot dead in Kentucky, and you had another person sending pipe bombs to 14 people on the left, right? And there's a great article on The Intercept. And by the way, folks, we've referenced two articles today. One is the Atlantic article on Newt Gingrich, and the other is an Intercept article on false equivalency. Google by those terms, you'll be able to find them. But when we post this show, I'll also post links to those stories, but feel free to Google them. But after those instances happened, to say nothing of all the other nonsense that's happened in the last few years, those instances happening in such rapid succession, you would think that hate and extremism would get such a sounding rebuke from mainstream media, mm-hmm. that it would cause these groups to cower, but it didn't happen. And this Intercept article does a tremendous job. The article is Natasha Leonard, and it does a great, it's an October 31, 2018 article. And she does a great job of just painting the picture of how wrong the media is, mainstream media is, for putting these false equivalencies together. Let me read to you if you don't care. The response from the New York Times editorial board last weekend offers a case in false equivalencies and platitudes under the veneer of anti-racism. The board went as so far as to noting that hate appears to be on the rise in an op-ed which cited statistics showing that anti-Semitic and racist not only appears to be, but in fact is on the rise. And the board's main solution was to call for more good speech from more good people. And further, NBC we're talking the same time. This is sort of right after all this rash of events. Chuck Todd on Meet the Press brings on National Republican Congressional Committee Chair Representative Steve Stivers from Ohio about an anti-Semitic GOP ad featuring George Soros, the one that got canceled, the ad they had to take off the air. But then he immediately turned to a Democratic guest and said, "You guys do it too with the Koch brothers." And it's that sense of like, whoa,
yeah.
how in the world are you comparing, you know, this notion that somehow we're not acknowledging the damage and the potential maelstrom of racism and anti-Semitism, and how are you comparing that with criticism of the Koch brothers? These guys are industrialists who are doing everything in their power to influence policy and positions to benefit themselves financially and change the fabric of America. I mean, these criticisms of these two things, this is not an equivalent criticism. I mean, it's so frustrating.
It is. And, you know, this idea that the media must present this both-siderism is the term that the article points out is really frustrating to me because, you know, why are you giving a platform to someone who is a nationalist white supremacist? Why are you doing this? It's wrong.
Literally giving them a microphone.
That's
giving
right.
them a camera spot.
I think we saw this a lot during the 2016 election, where you would have a liberal Democratic point of view, you would have a conservative GOP point of view, and then you would have a Trump supporter viewpoint. And it's this constant I think this has to go back to in the past, where there used to be, I think there was a law that you had to give equal time. And that was struck down.
Yeah. I remember years ago complaining, like I reached out to the FCC and God, I can't remember. This was like 2005 or 2006 and complained about something that was said. And the response I got, I like literally got a response back from somebody. And it was so eye-opening that like, oh no, you can pretty much say anything you want on television. Like, I mean, like there is no... Truth is dead,
right?
You can say there's no consequence for what you say.
Right. And I think we see a lot of that being played out now is, you know, how many lies has the president told since he became in office? And I know people are tracking this. It's in the thousands. It's like every day. And it's like the poor fact checkers have calluses on all of their fingers.
So according to a September 2018, September the 13th, right? So what, 2 months ago? The president has made over 5,000 false or misleading claims.
Right.
5,000.
Right. And the problem happens is when we have an electorate and a populace that do not have the critical thinking skills in order to really, and let's be honest, okay, over 5,000 lies, who has the time to really go and check those things out? So you know those fallacies are being spoon-fed to people and they believe them.
And the rise of social media gives the proponents of that kind of propaganda a direct path to those ears, to those eyes, an unfiltered path. And, you know, I'm not anti-American. I'm very much a capitalist. I've not seen a better economic engine work that I think would be successful in America. I mean, socialism in the Icelandic countries seems to be popular for those folks, but they live their life in a way that our people don't live their lives. So I don't know that it would ever be successful here. Do I think we should probably consider it in some aspects, like healthcare? Yeah, I do. But I'm very much a believer in our country, but I don't want our country being changed. I don't want the bedrock of things like free speech, freedom of the press. I don't want these things undermined and eroded by a president who constantly attacks the media. I can be critical of the media in how I feel their false equivalencies are not right. At the same time, stand up for their right to be able to report the way they need to report. But I am worried. I'm worried. I'm not going to lie.
Well, and getting a very specific example, maybe not so much on the meta of ideas and ideologies, but just let's take a look at the controversy that Hillary Clinton had
Lock her up.
That's
lock
right. And all of this was based on the use of email. But we have a similar story that came out not too long ago about Ivanka Trump, who was using a personal email address for governmental business. And rather than the press and the media taking a hold of this and really running, it did not even make the front page of any newspaper.
Did you see the movie Zoolander, where Will Ferrell's character says, "I feel like I'm taking crazy pills"? That's how I feel most days when I watch the news. It's stunning. It is the exact behavior that has resulted in Trump getting chance of lock her up in literally every political rally he's held. And yet somehow it's not an issue anymore for someone else.
Right. So I mean, it's instances like that really where we have to be aware of what's going on. But you know, it comes down to, well, how do we deal with this?
And that's an excellent question. And it's probably worth an episode on its own, because I feel like part of the problem, I feel like we are part of the problem, right? Because it's so freaking obvious to us that people are not well informed, and they are not aware of why these things matter and why these lies and distortions and exaggerations and baseless claims of massive voter fraud. Like, you are undermining the confidence in Americans' voting process, and you're undermining the First Amendment to free speech and to freedom of the press. And the fact that folks don't get why these things should matter, and they don't get why you shouldn't call all Mexicans rapists and drug dealers, and you don't get why calling a woman a pig is not a good thing, to say nothing of grab them by the pussy. You know, the fact that, like, how do you have that argument with somebody? How do you get them to understand that you need to be concerned about this? Because when all we're doing is, it's those two magnets that repel each other. That's all that's happening. It's not oil and water in the same bottle. We're not even in the same bottle, right?
Right.
Because they're so offended by our elitist attitudes and our elitist opinions and our, you know, intellectual. And I'm not a fucking intellectual. You know, I mean, I'm just not. But I try and read, and I try and educate myself, and I try and understand why these things matter. But I don't know. I have zero understanding of how it's going to get better.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's something that we should explore in a coming episode.
Well, Mark, it's been good catching up. I think we should probably leave it there. If folks are still listening at this point, their hand on the wall, maybe give them a break. Oh, goodness.
Right. And I think one of those breaks is really, I can't stress self-care enough during this time. And I'm not saying that self-care means you have to go out to the spa and you have to pamper yourself or anything like that. Is self-care also means taking the time, paying your electric bill, you know, that those day-to-day chores that can seem overwhelming in retrospect, if you add our current milieu into the mix, you know, it's taking care of yourself, making sure that you're supporting yourself and that you are supporting others, because we're all in this together. And like George says, I do believe in America. I am an American, and I'd like my country back, please.
Maybe that's the title of the show. I'd like my country back, please.
Please.
Let's put that on bright red hats and sell it.
So, George, if any of the listeners wanted to get in touch with us, how can they do that?
Well, Mark and I are both on Twitter. That's probably the quickest way. I am at George in Atlanta, at George in Atlanta.
And I am Laughing Buddha. That's LaughingBuddha. And George, do you have an email address as well?
You can email me at giapodcast@gmail.com.
Yes. And if you send anything in, George will let us know.
Absolutely. Please continue to stay tuned. Mark and I'll do these episodes as the spirit moves us.
Exactly.
As we say in the South. Mark, have a great day up in the chilly north.
All right. And you have a balmy 71 degree day.
Exactly. And it's, we're getting there. It is 71. Yep.
It's 71
right now. There we go.
It's going to go below freezing here momentarily.
I will light a candle in your honor.
Thank you.
All right. Have a good day.
Yep. You too. Take care, George.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The North and South of Things. More information available at northandsouthofthings.com. Follow Mark on Twitter at Laughing Buddha. That's LaughingBuddha. And George at George in Atlanta. Our podcast theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.
This show is part of the Pride 48 Network. Find more shows over at pride48.com.